another dimension, a dimension of insight, a dimension of understanding. You are entering a place where reality collides with truth. There are no limits, there are no boundaries. This is Off Planet Radio.
Well, good evening and welcome to Off Planet Radio Live. I'm Randy Mockins. And you know, just about the time you think you've got things figured out, something screws up in an even better way than before. Welcome, welcome, welcome. We're 10 minutes late due to phone connection issues and crashing audio software. And it is the peril-fraught, always interesting, never boring, but sometimes tension providing Off Planet Radio Live. It's Wednesday night, May 22nd, 2013, and strange days indeed. And we have a good show lined up for tonight. Very interesting subject matter. We're kind of staying in the groove with the UFO thing right now. We have some other shows coming up in the near future that will diverge from that path, but never too much because everything's connected. And Chris Holly is off tonight. She will be back again next week, because next week our guest is going to be radio talk show host, ufologist Kate Valentine will be with us for 2 hours. And it looks a lot sometimes like maybe the world, the mainstream, is catching up with us. I don't know how many people saw this. I posted yesterday to the Off Planet Radio blog, offplanetradio.com, an article from Forbes.com about cold fusion. LENR, low energy nuclear reaction, has been independently tested. Dr. Rossi Z-CAT device has been independently tested by an outside laboratory, and the conclusion was, quote, a high temperature development of the original apparatus, which also has undergone many construction changes in the last 2 years, is the latest product manufactured by Leonardo Corporation. It is a device allegedly capable of producing heat from some type of reaction, the origin of which is unknown. And of course, that's the outside scientist talking, but it is said that the reaction coming from the Rossi low energy nuclear reaction machine is in fact quite profound. And so we have for the first time a confirmation of cold fusion, 0-point energy, and this is important. It's a game changer. I don't think we're going to see it here in the United States anytime soon, but it will begin to move the conversation towards free energy. And interestingly enough, it's connected in many different ways to the UFO alien thing as well. I don't think they're driving big block diesels out there in the galaxies. The other thing that's interesting to connect is mainstream media is getting the message. A May 10th, 2013 article at VanityFair.com, Alien Nation of Humans Been Abducted by Extraterrestrials. It's an excellent article on the late Dr. John Mack, written by Ralph Blumenthal at VanityFair.com. There's hope that the world is catching up with us. These are signs of hope in an otherwise dark world. And our thoughts and our prayers with those out there in Oklahoma who were affected by this horrible superstorm that hit the midsection of the country. And without a lot of further ado, I want to bring on my guests tonight. They were, individually, they would be almost fascinating guests by themselves, but together they provide a very potent team discussing the very things that we've talked about on this show for many years. The book is called The Alien Abduction Files, the most startling cases of human-alien contact ever reported. It is on New Page Books, and the book is just out. My guests tonight are Denise Stoner and Kathleen Martin. And ladies, good evening and welcome to Off Planet Radio.
Hello. Good evening. Be with you.
And it'll be for a while here in the interview. We'll just have to distinguish between the two voices. But yeah, first off, when was the book released?
The book was released on May 20th.
Okay.
Just this week.
Yeah, that's what I thought. And that was the voice of Kathleen Morden. And my other guest with us is Denise Stoner. Of the two of you, Denise is an experiencer, an abductee, and Kathleen is the niece of Betty Hill of the 1960s original, I guess, abduction case, Betty and Barney Hill. So let's start off with Kathleen and give us a little bit of your background, Kathleen.
Okay. Well, I was born and grew up in the state of New Hampshire. I was 13 years old when my aunt Betty called my mother to tell her that she and my uncle had had a close encounter with a flying saucer in New Hampshire's White Mountains the day before. There was physical evidence. We went to Betty's and Barney's house within a couple of days of the time of the event and saw the physical evidence, heard the story, and I was always fascinated with that throughout my lifetime. But I grew up, went to college, became a social worker, and then left social work and became a teacher and an education services coordinator. And although I maintained an interest in UFOs and alien abduction, I didn't start researching it full-time pretty much until 1990. And that is when I asked my Aunt Betty Hill to turn over her files to me. I would like to interview her. I would like to investigate her abduction and do all of the research I possibly could on it. Over the next 14 years, she turned over about 40 years worth of files, all the original investigation reports, reports to and from scientists, correspondents, information that had never been released before because it was confidential until after Betty's death in 2004. And this was the framework for my book, Captured, The Betty and Barney Hill UFO Experience, that Stanton Friedman co-authored. He wrote the two chapters about the star map in that book and assisted me with the book that I had written. And from there, Stan and I wrote the book, Science Was Wrong. And it's interesting, you just mentioned cold fusion. Stan wrote a chapter on cold fusion in Science. Mm-hmm.
I knew that, actually. And that was just one of those interesting synchronicity tie-ins. Knew that Stanton had written that article in that book.
Yes, and then Ralph Blumenthal had interviewed me for the article in Vanity Fair.
There you go. Now, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Yes, and I am now a full-time abduction researcher. I also have an acute interest in government involvement and government cover-ups in UFOs, and together with Denise about 3.5 years ago, I would say, when I moved to Florida. I had always lived in New Hampshire, or at least since the mid-1980s. I grew up there, too. But my husband retired to Florida. I can't say I retired, but he did, about 3.5 years ago. I looked up Denise at that time. I'd had some email exchanges with her before that, and attended some of her meetings. She holds meetings in Florida for experiencers and also public interest meetings on UFOs. And she invited me to her home at that. And that's when we really got to know each other. And eventually she told me that she had been abducted by a craft She told me about an event she'd had in Colorado, and I'll let her finish that. But she didn't have a very good memory of the hypnosis sessions that she had had in Colorado following that abduction experience. I'm also a hypnotist with advanced training in aggression and post-traumatic stress disorder, and I offered to help her to refresh her memory. And eventually, her story became part of the book. So I'll let Denise go on now.
Yeah, Denise, you bring to the table, I guess, what we call the experiential side of the team in terms of abductions that you've undergone. There were a number of them over the years, and in fact, I believe, if I read correctly, you're probably a lifetime experiencer as well.
Yes, I am, and I have full memory of childhood. What happened to me, and it's very, very clear. It's still there, just as if it happened yesterday. I keep seeing it over and over again, and I think that happens to a lot of people. I just didn't realize that the little creature that I was seeing when I was little wasn't an invisible friend. It was real. It took me a few years to figure that out. And I had someone in Colorado that I worked with. He has passed away now. I trusted him a great deal. And I had gone to him, actually, to work in helping individuals through hypnosis to control crime. And that's what he was doing to begin with. And then we found out we had a mutual interest in UFOs and began to work together. And he taught me his hypnosis techniques at that time. Before I actually took the courses myself, I worked with him for 5 years. So we began to explore about the same time that Kathleen did, this procedure and gaining information on what I had been through. And since it was all put on tape at the time, all of that became foggy. Once it was put down, I thought, okay, that's there. I can get it if I need it. What I didn't realize at the time was that we were going to move to Florida. The tapes stayed in Colorado, and they were gone.
And you didn't have a transcription as well, I take it?
No, I did not. He had everything. So I had lost through raising children and working full-time, all of those kinds of things that life involves you in. Had lost all of that, yeah.
How many years did it take you from childhood? I'm assuming you were probably 5 or younger when you had your initial contact experiences.
2.5.
2.5. That's the youngest age I've heard yet.
Yes, it's clear because my mother was in the hospital giving birth to my sister.
There was no doubt
in my mind. I can put right on that night. And my grandfather was taking care of me. My grandparents lived with us, and they always did. They had come over from Scotland, and they shared a home with my parents always. So he was there taking care of me, and I saw a huge, which I now know was a craft in the sky. I was standing on the sofa. I'm looking out the window, and he was doing the dishes. He fixed dinner for both of us, and I saw just this enormous craft. I thought it was Humpty Dumpty. As a child, that's how your mind works. And it was so close. It was the walls from the telephone poles were going right across the center of it. And I thought, oh, it's going to fall. Humpty Dumpty's going to fall. And he came through, my grandfather, and I showed him, and I said, what's he doing up in the sky? And I can see the fear registered on his face. That is just as clear today as it was then. And my grandfather wasn't one to fear or any other emotions other than he was happy to be with me. And he showed a few, closed the window or the curtains and said, come on, we're going to go up and get a bath and get you ready for bed. because it was dark already, and he did. He took me upstairs, we had a bath, and then he put me to bed. And he went back downstairs. I was on the second floor, and it was shortly after that I was just lying in bed looking at the nursery rhyme wallpaper, all the characters in the nursery rhymes, and pretty soon here came a character that was not a part of the nursery rhymes. It was a little figure. It was hooded and carrying either an instrument or a tool. It was lit on one end, and the character had great big dark eyes. And I figured it was a new nursery rhyme character. And he reached out and took my hand and led me bed into the hall, and we went right through the wallpaper in the hallway and entered a huge craft.
When you
go ahead.
When you think back on that memory now, are you able to kind of engage the mind of the child that you were at that age? Because it sounds to me like you're very much in touch with the imagery that you had at that age, even down to associating it with what you would have understood as storybook characters and things like that. It sounds like you really connect with that person at that time in this experience. It's one of the things that I listen for when I talk to people who are contactees.
I did. I even gave him a name from another nursery rhyme that we don't hear anymore, and it was Wee Willie Winkie. I don't know if you know.
Yes, I do remember. I remember that in my storybooks, too.
Okay, that's what I named him. That's who I thought he was, because I can't even remember to repeat it, but it was something about upstairs, downstairs. I don't know if it was all through the night, but he was like a little shadow, and he carried a lantern. And so that's who I thought would come to visit me, never harmed me. I just thought he was coming to teach me and to keep me company. I liked to have someone with me that was more adult. Rather than other children, so this was fantastic for me.
So you didn't really have a sense, looking back on this memory now, you didn't really have a sense of fear about this at the time, did you, Denise?
No, not at all. Mm-mm. No, I thought it was terrific. And then I did try to explain to my parents. I never spoke to my grandfather again about it because I knew the fear on his face. But I did speak to my mom, and she thought that I had an invisible friend. That's exactly what she thought. But she went right along with it and said, well, that's terrific. What did you do here? What did you do there? Well, I didn't have the verbiage to say I was taken on a craft. He took me to play, and we played games, and that's about all I said at the time. There was a baby sister in the house to be worried about, and so it was very brief conversations.
Did you continue to have experiences throughout childhood? Did the experiences stop, or do your memories simply drop off at a certain point, Denise?
That little figure went away, and we moved into a brand new house that my parents built. And then I was an older child, and then I became afraid because I would find myself standing. It was a New England town, a very quiet town. We never locked our doors. It was more of a Norman Rockwell painting type town.
Yeah.
And I would catch myself standing in the park in the middle of the night that was down the street from us, wondering how I got there. And I would start to run. I was chased by someone that I called the oil can man. I couldn't describe him any other way as an older child from first grade on. And he had arms that were very long, and he could reach and catch me. And I would run. And he had something in his hand that would drip some kind of fluid on me. And I would run till I got to my front door, and I could get in and get upstairs, and no one noticed. I could get into my bed and go to sleep, and everybody else in the house was sleeping. And it happened over and over again. And I recall being on a craft with that individual. They always seemed to put me back in that park, standing in the grass.
Now, do you have memories of going onto the craft itself and what occurred there at that particular age?
I was put on a craft. I remember things developing a little bit further. I think took some skin samplings. I had some things happen to me. I have not researched that under hypnosis, but something made me more afraid. I didn't like that chased me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what he did. We haven't explored that.
So we kind of go forward now. You got through school. You sort of had a... Did you sort of transition into what we would call a normal life? And was that fairly uninterrupted by these events, or did they continue?
They were not quite as often. I had something happen when we moved from that town to California. And again, I was chased, but this time I was wide awake. I was walking home, and my dad was now working at Aerojet. He had gone into aerospace, and the whole family moved to California, and I was walking down a hill, and I was chased and ran into a girlfriend's house. And I just discussed this with her the other day. She does not recall it, but she may be developing dementia. And so we don't. She's going to ask her two brothers because they were there. And we had called a policeman because whoever it was ran into their backyard. And the policeman came out and said, I can't go back there. I don't have any assistance. And I'm all done. He got in his car and took off.
Wow.
And, yeah. So he was frightened, obviously, but the whoever it was definitely an entity that chased me. Her dad had asked us to sit down in the living room, and we all did, our family room, by those sliding glass doors facing the backyard, and this entity looked in the glass at us.
Mm-hmm.
And we all saw it. The policeman was in the backyard at the far end. We could see the light from his flashlight.
Do you have any recollection of what this entity was? Was it a solid being? Was it something that was kind of formless? It was solid.
No, it was no solid. It was more of what someone would describe as insectoid.
Okay.
Yeah. And then her dad watched me as I ran home two houses down. And I did tell my mom, and I asked her the other night if she recalled it, and she said yes. She doesn't have a clear memory of it, but she remembers me running home and telling her what had happened, that I'd been chased and that the policeman left, and what he had said.
Listening to your narrative, Denise, and especially the reaction of your grandfather, I'm guessing that maybe perhaps this is a generational situation and that maybe even your grandfather may have been aware of what was going on? Or am I making a stretch there?
I don't know anything about my grandparents, but I do know something might have happened to my mom and my dad.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
In that same house. And their bedrooms, my grandparents and my parents' bedrooms were right next to each other, and there was a door that opened between the two in the first house that they ever purchased. It was an older home, and it was kind of different, the way it all worked. They were at one end of the hall, and my parents saw a light coming towards the double windows in their bedroom one night. And my dad had been a gunner in a B-17, so he was real good at space and lights and distance and all that kind of thing. And my mom and my dad were watching these lights moving very slowly from the second story of the home. And my dad said to my mom, if that thing doesn't go up or down, it's going to hit our house. And the next thing they remembered, it was morning. So something happened that night. And then my mom developed severe agoraphobia. felt like she was in a tube-like structure if she got on a city bus and panicked. Certain types of lights, different types of things that terrified her for a long time. Following that.
So these events basically followed you through your early life and wherever you went. I mean, obviously, California, there's a lot of phenomena there as well. It's a hot spot, as is you later on relocated, I believe, to Colorado. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. To a town first way up in the mountains. It's called Gunnison. It's in the middle of nowhere, virtually, and we sighted a craft there in broad daylight. The people that were living there with us, all in the same apartment complex, all kind of said, well, hey, we see those all the time, type attitude, and went inside when we called them out to look at it. And then we moved down to Denver, the Denver area, and that's when we had the episode that's written in the book.
Yeah, let's talk about the episode a little bit in the book, and then let's talk about the book and bring Kathleen back into the narrative as well. The episode in the book not only involved you, but also your husband, correct?
Yes, my husband, my daughter, our daughter was sleeping in the back seat of the car. And we had a little bit of a problem with gas mileage, and my husband had been setting the trip meter for quite a while. And it was a newer car, so we wanted to make sure that there wasn't anything wrong. So this one particular day, he had set the trip meter. We were very used to taking this trip. We had had this place up in the mountains for a long time, and we left at 5 in the evening, packed the car with everything we took for a time that we would stay for 3 days, and we were leaving from, like I said, the Denver area. My parents were leaving with a longtime family friend from Colorado Springs, and we had told them, as we usually did, we'll be there right around 8 o'clock, somewhere in there, 8:15, no later. And we always did that, so they didn't have to worry about us. Their trip was a little shorter than ours.
Mm-hmm.
So we headed out, and there's usually heavy traffic. Everybody wants out of town in Denver on a Friday night.
Yeah.
Or even a Thursday night. They leave early, and so there was a little bit of heavy traffic. Until we got to an area called Kenosha Pass. And you can look down from Kenosha Pass and see a glacier valley. Sunlight streaming across it. At the bottom of it was a little town called Jefferson, and for some reason I always watched that little town. I like to see it at the base of the pass. So I was watching, and I looked out across the high desert, and I could see two lights, and I had never seen them before, and they appeared to be moving really slowly, and I thought it was some strange anomaly caused by the sunlight at first. And then I began to realize, no, let's figure out what that is. But my husband and I were just talking, chatting away, enjoying the evening that was coming on. And I guess you'd say it was early evening. And so the sun was even glinting off the snow at the far side, and that's where we were headed. So we came through Jefferson. And at the base of the pass, and about 4 miles outside Jefferson, I noticed those lights were approaching us pretty fast. I could not see anything attached to them. They were, even with the sun shining, they were terribly bright. And they came up over the top of the car, and I turned to try to say something to my husband again, and he was staring straight ahead and was clutching the steering wheel, and he wasn't responding. It was like he just didn't know what was going on. His eyes were wide open, but he wasn't reacting to anything. So I leaned over to my right and leaned on the passenger side window and looked up, and the lights were right there. And as I did that, I felt the tires on the driver's side start to scrape on the road. And I thought, uh-oh, the car's moving sideways. This isn't good. We had big snow barriers at the time made of wood. They were tall. and they were meant to block any blowing snow or tumbleweeds that grew over 5 feet tall, which they did, and would break off at night and blow across the road, causing accidents.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, we're going to hit those barriers, and we're going to get in an accident, so I don't know what's causing this. And there was no wind that night. So all of a sudden, I'm watching the barriers, and I thought, we're going to hit them. And the car lifted up and went over the top of the barriers. And we headed out over the high desert. And I was looking around, looking at my husband. My daughter was still asleep. And I could see all the way across that desert. The sun was shining. And I couldn't see anything except knowing there was that object with the lights over the car. We went way out in that high desert, and then the car started to slow down. And I knew we were going to stop. I didn't know why. I didn't know what was going to happen. I did not relate it to any of my past. And then the car came to a stop. I felt it settle down. The next thing I knew, we were on Trout Creek Pass on the other side of the Glacier Valley. And we were up high on top of the pass. I looked around. I was panicking. I was afraid. I was disoriented. My husband had come too. He was in the same state I was, and it was pitch dark. And it should still have been somewhat light out. He looked at the trip meter. It hadn't changed. It had not moved. It read the same as it had when we left Kenosha Pass. He said, let's pull over. We need to get our wits about us. We need to try and figure out what just happened. I was saying, what the heck just happened here? So we pulled over. Our daughter was okay. Little dog was okay. We were not okay. He hadn't realized that we were lifted off the road. He just was searching blindly for some answer. Something that he couldn't remember at all, and then we decided we better get going. My parents are waiting for us, so we headed on. There were another 9 or so miles to go to where we camped. And when we got there, my parents and friend were waiting. They had walked to the ranch house. They were going to use a phone to start calling the police and the hospital. And then my dad and friend were going to get in the car and drive our path to see if we'd gone off the cliff or if we were stuck somewhere on the road, because there were no cell phones and no phones on that whole route we had taken. And they asked us, where have you been? What's gone on? Did you get stuck at home, or did you, what happened? And the only answer we could give was, we don't know. And my dad, being in aerospace, kind of said, well, I guess we can't do anything but accept that. Maybe we'll have to talk about it some more. We'll have to think about it. My mom always had to have an answer from me. She would not accept that kind of answer. So she kept at us. You've got to have an answer. You've got to give me an answer. I have a need to know. And we just still came up with, don't know. We really don't know. And that's what happened.
It's unbelievable as it sounds. It is unbelievable to anybody who's not aware of what goes on with these type of abductions. Your husband was actually put into some sort of state even as he was driving that car. Does he have any recollection, any memory at all? Has he had regression or anything done to try and capture that period of time as he was going into that state?
Kathleen has worked with him to the degree that he will allow, and you can ask her what happened, because we didn't want either of our stories to get involved or mixed up at all. We did not discuss it, and she handled that.
Okay. Is that something we want to discuss at this juncture, or do we just want to let that go?
It doesn't matter. Kathleen can.
Kathleen, do you want to weigh in here with what you may know about that?
Sure, I can. Well, after a long time after I had hypnotized Denise, and I want to say that I had instilled amnesia again for many of her memories. She hadn't discussed it, anything that she remembered, with Ed. And I wanted to compare notes. I wanted to know if perhaps what Denise had stated under hypnosis matched up with what Ed would state under hypnosis. And so he agreed to permit me to hypnotize him as long as I didn't push him too far, and he didn't want to re-experience any trauma or being on board the craft if in fact he actually was. So I did hypnotize him. He did tell me in great detail, and I've put this into the book, his statements about his trip up to the point where there was something in the sky that Denise had drawn his attention to it, and that he then felt himself sort of sliding off the road. And the next thing he knew, as if only a moment had passed, he was 40 miles down the road. It had been, he'd checked the time, it was nearly 7 o'clock p.m., when he found himself in the new location on Trout Creek Pass, it was nearly 11 o'clock. He was freezing. He was upset, startled, just shaking his head, couldn't figure out what had gone on. And then I took him back and I to open up that lost memory. And he recalled finding himself in a different environment. He was lying down on some kind of a slab, mm-hmm. perhaps. He was in a room that seemed to have a domed ceiling, and it was dark, and he felt terribly lonely, not knowing where he was, and or when he would move on. And that was about all that he wanted to remember. And so then I didn't push him to go beyond that. But it gave me an indication that it seemed that he was probably in a room on that craft with Denise, but or in some kind of just state of suspended animation somewhere. It didn't appear that he was inside the car any longer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So based on the information that you got from that regression, he himself was or was not the subject of this particular abduction?
I can't say for certain. We know that he woke up in an environment that was different mm-hmm. than the one he had been in. He had been driving a vehicle. He then realized he was disoriented. He realized he was in a new location. He thought that Denise was drawing his attention to a house that was under construction. But, you know, instantly he found himself somewhere else. He's in a new environment, and he sees a smooth, dull, reflective domed ceiling overhead, which is very similar to Denise's description of the examining room on the craft. And he's now only sensing a feeling of detachment and waiting for an extended period of time. He doesn't know where Denise or his daughter are. He finally hears a frequency in a tenor range that reminds him of loud tinnitus. There's a heavy pulsation, and he feels frightened and cold. His weight then returns. He finds himself clinging to his steering wheel. It's suddenly dark outside, and he's freezing. His headlights are on, but he hadn't turned them on. He realizes that he's halfway up Trout Creek Pass. It's nearly 11 o'clock, and he said Denise is freaking out. They stopped for a few minutes to gather their thoughts and attempt to discern what had just happened to them. Neither could explain it.
So he literally returned to consciousness and the vehicle is moving. Is that correct?
Yes.
You see, this is the kind of detail that I find intriguing because so rarely do we get a chance to hear those kind of nuances. Having interviewed abductees for a number of years and talked to people, I get a lot of details, but this is probably one of the more detailed accounts that I've heard, and it's those little nuances in the narrative that make it not only just believable, but a fascinating case in terms of being able to actually visualize what was going on here. How about Denise's daughter? Do we have an account from her as well?
Yes. I don't... Well, Kathleen can own in, too, but I don't think Deanna was taken because she just knew that she was supposed to take her medication at a certain time at night. She's very good at that. She's mildly handicapped. And she wondered what we had been up to that kept her from getting to camp on time in order to take her medication.
Okay.
And I don't know if she said anything else to Kathleen. Do you recall?
No. She didn't remember being taken.
So, and I'm also very interested in the flow of conversation here because I'm learning a little bit about how investigations work, Kathleen. In reading your book, I'm very interested in how people research this type of information. You do seem to be able to compartmentalize things in a way that you're not leaking information, which would, I guess, contaminate memories and things like that. Is that correct?
That is correct. I make it a point not to contaminate memories.
So, now, this was, correct me on the dates here, this is like, what, 1984 or so this event occurred?
1982.
Okay.
It was August 13th, Friday. What a thing to happen on Friday the 13th.
So, this is quite a gap in time from when you and Kathleen connected with each other in Florida. In the intervening years, anything remarkable happened? Did you continue to have experiences?
Yes, we did. We moved to Florida. I took up scuba diving with my husband. We became instructors. And that wasn't good enough for me. I dragged him into the caves, and we took up underwater cave diving. In order to do that, we had to go to North Florida, where a lot of the sinks are. The Florida aquifer opens up to the surface in a lot of places in North Florida, so we had begun to go up there and found some favorite places, and we began to go there almost every single weekend because we knew we were older cave divers at that point. And at the time, there were very, very, maybe five women that were cave divers. And no one had even seen one when I started that till I came to the surface one day and they discovered I was a woman when I took my head off, my hood off. And we were actually taken on the way to go diving. It happened twice, but we've documented one. And that time, Kathleen worked with my husband, and he did see an entity return me to our truck. And she can describe that. He drew it for her, and then I drew pretty much the identical entity. And just before that, just prior to that, we both witnessed craft sitting in the farmer's field, because on the way to these dive sites, you don't go by specific directed signs. You actually have to say, oh, you turn left at the white fence and right at the farmer's field, and that's how you find these sinkholes. So that's what we were doing.
So you have two descriptions from two different people that match, but you and your husband never discussed this between yourselves. Is that correct?
No, and the reason that we didn't is because I was already in the UFO field, and I knew how to investigate, and I knew exactly what would happen if we did. We would say to each other, it happened again. It just happened again, didn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And we would say, yes, it did. Okay, let's draw what we saw. So we did that a couple of times as far as the craft went, and then we discovered there was a particular sense in our brains that would indicate we might be affected by something that was going to take us, because once on our way back from a trip, my mom happened to be following us with our daughter in the car, and our car just pulled off the road and ended up in a dirt road that was a back gate to one of our state parks. And we felt that feeling in our heads, we were going to be taken. My mom pulled in behind us, and the feeling went completely away. We looked at each other and said, we were going to be taken, and they know your mother's here, and it stopped.
You just said something interesting, and I want to follow this a little bit. The feeling that we're going to be taken, can you describe that?
Oh, boy, is that difficult. It's in the brain, mm-hmm. as far as we're concerned, as far as we know. It's a sensation in the brain, something that tells you you're going to be taken, it's coming, and you're not going to be able to stop it. It's just there.
Just kind of like a knowing?
I would say it's almost like you're going to hear a voice, but you don't. It's almost a electric or buzzing type feeling.
Okay, I got it. That's what I was going to ask you that. Did you sense some electrical sensation?
I would have to say, again, centered in the brain.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and that's something that, it's, again, one of those little nuances, but whenever I hear it, I like to pursue it as much as possible, because it's one of those, to me, ring of truth type things that says, yeah, you know, this is for real. And I know you both kind of share the same thing, that many other people who are working in this field, whether they're researchers, investigators, experiencers, contactees, whatever, the frustration comes with the fact that we're dealing with subjects where there is no so-called hard, tangible evidence, and it's great frustration for a lot of people. As researchers, you both deal with that ambiguity of information that, other than maybe photographs that people get of marks on their body and some of the documented evidence that I've seen over the years, there is no way that you can lead what I'll call a skeptic kindly to the conclusion that what you're saying has a ring of truth. Is that something that is now kind of ingrained into your narrative in terms of expressing yourself and also in the way you research? I hope that question came out clearly.
Well, Kathleen, I think can describe something we've discovered that's very, very new to us, and we're going to be able to approach that in a whole new way, because I was taken again in February, and something happened to Kathleen at the same time that affected both of our vehicles and affected me physically, and we've got video of it. So, Kathleen, you want to explain that a little bit?
Yes, I will explain it, but first I wanted to state that we have eyewitness testimony from both Ed, from Denise, and from Denise's mother that something happened that night, and eyewitness testimony is important as well. We know that 40 miles was lost. We know that there's no prosaic explanation for that is acceptable for what occurred that night. But moving on, as Denise is continuing to experience these events, we have the capability now to get on the case immediately. And Denise did have an experience on February 2nd of this year. the two of us had been driving. My father was with us. We went to a meeting in St. Pete, Florida, and we drove then back to Winter Garden, a couple of hours' drive, where Denise was going to pick up her car and continue on to her house, and I was going to continue on to my home, which was probably about three-quarters of an hour for each of us both ways. Along the route on the way home, some strange things started to occur. My car's GPS system started to malfunction. It kept wanting me to turn off the highway. I did, in fact, at one point, and realized that I shouldn't have done that, and got back on the highway. Denise's telephone that had been fully charged suddenly went dead. She has an insulin pump. She had a 3-month battery life on that insulin pump. It was fully charged. It went dead. So those were a couple of important things that I observed. When she returned to her car, something was malfunctioning. First, it was her the exterior mirror on the driver's side. And she got into the car. She's driving home, and suddenly she finds herself on a new road that she hadn't been on and doesn't know how she arrived there. She has the experience. She calls me the following day and tells me that something has happened to her the night before, and she tells me everything that she can remember. Well, Denise has a tri-field meter, and there was a problem with the dashboard equipment after that as well. So she was able to take the tri-field meter out to her vehicle, and she discovered that there was a strong electromagnetic field around the dashboard and that exterior mirror on her car.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to see that too, so she did bring the car over to my house a few days later, and I was able to observe what the malfunctioning of the equipment, but a very strange thing happened that suddenly it started working again that afternoon when she was ready to go home. Now, I did hypnotize her that day, but one thing that I wanted to mention that was really important to me, this is a new discovery, I believe, we set the tri-field meter to different settings. I wanted to see if there was an electromagnetic field coming from her body. And what we discovered is we turned it to the electrical field reading. And when Denise got within 10 feet of that electrical field reading, the needle went to full capacity and the tri-meter sounded that it was at full capacity. Now, we tested this with other people as well. We tested it with my husband, and it didn't move. And we had the meter in the same place. We moved it to different locations in the house. Denise took off her jewelry, took off anything that might have caused that to happen. It still continued to arc to full capacity. Denise took it home. She tried it with her husband. She tried it with her daughter. The same results as with my husband, that it just moved slightly, indicating any human has a little bit of an electrical field.
Right.
Hers was very strong.
That's off the scale for it to move to capacity. I mean, and you mean she pushed that meter the whole way over?
She absolutely did, and
okay.
It makes a noise when it goes.
Yes, I'm very familiar with the meters.
All the way over.
Yeah.
And her body did that, and it stayed that way for a couple of weeks at least before it started to decrease.
So did you also get similar readings from the vehicle itself, or was it simply, this is interesting. The vehicle itself was registering one anomaly, but she was registering this anomaly, almost like her body was a capacitor holding an electrical field.
Yes. Yes, that is true. And I discussed this. I was out in Phoenix, Arizona for the International UFO Congress.
Right.
And I discussed this with Dr. Roger Lear's material scientist, Stephen Colburn.
Yeah.
And I said, can you explain why this is happening? It's happened twice now to two different experiencers that I've worked with. And he said that it would make sense that if a person had been in an alien environment, that would occur.
This would also explain why various experiencers tend to have electrical and electronic anomalies around them. Denise, you undoubtedly have experienced electrical anomalies, blowing out light bulbs, things like that?
Yes. Yeah, I have. And now I'm just I'm blowing the fuses in my car radio. I can't keep them running, and there's nothing else wrong with that car, and it then stops and the radio works just fine.
So you now have the ability to basically follow up Kathleen with Denise when she has another one of these encounters. Were you able to do any regression work in terms of recapturing memories from that February 2nd event?
Oh, yes, absolutely. And Denise told me that as she relived this in hypnosis, that she, as she was driving along, an ET stepped out from behind a stand of trees. Her car stopped, and she was taken aboard a craft. She was taken into a room, and a short procedure was done. It did not take a long period of time. She observed two other humans on the craft as well, and she got caught just a glimpse of them. There was a woman and an older man who appeared to be balding. And she wasn't able to identify them. In fact, this sort of piqued my curiosity because my father is an older balding man, and I was in the car with her that night, and so we were wondering, gee, did they pick the three of us up when we before? And so we have no answer to that, because she only caught a glimpse of those people and couldn't identify. So they probably were not my father and myself, but it was interesting nevertheless. But she just had just a short procedure. It might have been just changing an implant, for example, from the way she described it, and then was taken back to her car and was on her way.
You mentioned, well, let me ask you this, Kathleen. Do you believe that you're also an experiencer?
Well, I don't know. I'm pretty curious about this. Certainly the possibility exists. Because it does run in family,
right?
And of course, my Aunt Betty was conducting contact experiments with a team of scientists back in the 1960s in order to attempt a vector in a craft. And when she was doing these experiments, we started to have close encounters ourselves. I grew up across the street from my grandparents' farm in Kingston, New Hampshire, and Betty was attempting to vector the craft into my grandparents' farm. And there was a landing during that time frame when I was still living at my parents' house. And there was physical trace evidence left on the ground. One of our neighbors was a commercial pilot. He was returning home at night. He saw the craft coming in. It woke my grandparents up, and they observed it, pretty frightened by it, but it was sitting out there on the ground. And then, after that occurred, we started to have paranormal activity in my childhood home, and we had never heard that before. and it was poltergeist activity. It was light orbs shooting through the air as well. And, you know, it was a little unsettling for my family to suddenly have this occur. And what really has sparked my curiosity is that 88% of the experiencers that participated in the Marden Stoner commonality study stated that they had paranormal activity in their homes. Mm-hmm. And over half of them stated that it occurred for the first time after their experience.
I think when we're going to take a break here for a few minutes. When we come back, I'd like to pursue that a little bit more. I also would like to discuss a little bit more about the book and some of the other people that you write about in the book. The book is The Alien Abduction Files. It's written by Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner. And you guys want to give out your websites and book information at this point? Let people know where they can find you and where they can get the book.
Sure. My website is Kathleen, Kathleen-Marden, Marden.com. You can also, you can get autographed copies of the book at the website. I have several articles there and also a list of all of my speaking engagements this year. You can purchase the book at Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. It is now in bookstores everywhere, and it is now available on Kindle as well. And why don't you go ahead, Denise?
Mm-hmm. Yes, you can purchase an autographed copy through my website also, which is DeniseEmisonMargaretStoner.com, and I'll be listing some places where I'll be speaking and holding my private abductee meetings.
Excellent. I'll take a break here. It'll probably be about 7 minutes or so. So, you know, if you guys want to go take a rest break in the meantime, we'll come back on the other side. We're going to talk more about the Alien Abduction Files and what really is going on out there in the world of abductions. I'm Randy Moggins. This is Off Planet Radio. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. and welcome back to the second hour of Off Planet Radio Live for May 22nd, 2013, 22. Always, it's always one of those synchronistic numbers. The whole concept of synchronicity fascinates me beyond what I can even describe sometimes. It's kind of one of those things that I notice people who have paranormal experiences talk about. And maybe we can find out a little bit more about that with my guests, Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner. The book is The Alien Abduction Files, the most startling cases of human-alien contact ever reported. This is a resource book if you're serious about ufology. It's one of those that you need to have in your library. We're just touching the surface tonight, but I think we're also getting some fresh information as well. Kathleen and Denise, welcome back to the second hour.
Good to be back.
Yeah, the phone lines have been really, really strange tonight, and we'll muddle through it. I was talking when I came in on the intro about synchronicities and anomalies, and this is something that is always an interesting part of the experiencer's life. Can you talk a little bit about that, and can you talk a little bit about, I don't know if you understand what I mean by synchronicities or not, but maybe you can address that if that's part of your experience.
It's interesting because I started the introduction with the synchronicity of how Denise and I met and discovered that at one point she had lived in Gunnison, Colorado, and I had lived only about 30 miles away from her in Crested Butte, Colorado, and that we might have observed the same UFO at the same time. So we found that we had some things in common there. But there's also an incredibly synchronous event in the abduction files that we wrote about, and that is that Denise and Jenny Henderson, who is the second experiencer in the book of several experiences we wrote about, but Jenny's case is just as extensive as Denise's. And I discovered, as I was working with both women separately. I had worked with Jenny when I was in New Hampshire for a period of, at least a dozen years. And she had told me about something that came to her as kind of a dreamlike experience. And she didn't know if it was real or not, or if it was only a dream, but she had found herself on a large craft in a mountainous area. And she was very frightened. She had, the ETs apparently had trusted her, but she tried to evade them and went to hide in a room. So she described all of the experience to me, and all of it is in the book. But as I was working with Denise, I had never mentioned Jenny. Denise knew nothing about Jenny or her experiences. And Denise started to tell me about an event that she had in a mountainous area on a craft that she described as exactly like the craft that Jenny described. And then she's told me about a woman who appeared to be frightened and who attempted to escape. And she was holding the hand of a younger woman. And I asked Denise to describe what Jenny was wearing. And then I went back and asked Jenny to describe what individuals that she had observed on the craft. And come to find out, they both had the clothing that was described. And later, Jenny and Denise met. And we think that there's a good possibility that they might have been on the same craft at the same time.
And so there's kind of almost like a perfect triangulation between you, Kathleen, Denise is the experiencer, and Jenny, who is the person you write about in the book. Let's go into a little bit about Jenny's case history, how you came to handle that particular investigation, and why it is that Jenny does not present her story personally.
Okay. Well, Jenny is a young woman. She grew up in New Hampshire. She's not young anymore. When she was a teenager, she had a missing time event when she was in a vehicle driving to a high school event after she had a close encounter with a UFO. When she arrived at the high school event, it had ended. And she had about a two-hour period of missing time. After that, she started to have bedroom abduction events. And eventually went to Dr. James Harder. She had contacted him through my Aunt Betty Hill. So there's a little more synchronicity there. And Jim had hypnotized her. Now, Jim Harder, Dr. James Harder, a professor at the University of California. And he was also a chief investigator, head investigator for the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, and was a very, very active abduction researcher. And he was the one who originally made the connection between experiences and the fact that it appears to follow family genetic lines. So he and Betty worked with Jenny for a period of time, and I wasn't even aware of her case. But over time, she had sort of lost contact with my aunt, wasn't seeing her as often. And I had been speaking in New Hampshire. People were coming to know who I was and my name. I was teaching courses in the history of UFO abductions at the Exeter High School. And Jenny found me, and she called me up and started talking to me about her events. And she didn't want a formal investigation. She knew that I was an investigator for the Mutual UFO Network at that time. I was also the director of field investigator training at that time. But we just investigated her case kind of quietly and privately. She didn't want anyone to know her identity, and she still does not. She's married to a successful businessman, prominent in the community. She's very concerned about her reputation, her family's financial well-being, very concerned if this got out to the public that it could simply destroy their credibility and their business.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so for that reason, she has asked me not to.
It's kind of sad, isn't it? Isn't it sad that this is the taboo that we now deal with? All the barriers in our culture that have broken down over the last 40 years, this is really the big taboo now, isn't it?
It really is. It very much is. And so many people still feel the need to hide their identities for their own well-being. Because people who do reveal their identities have a history of being attacked, either by debunkers or by even skeptical UFO investigators, and by members of the public. It's just not very pleasant for a lot of people, but I think we're moving forward. I think that, like Denise said the other night, that she hasn't been attacked yet, which is a very good thing.
Well, and that's one of the reasons why I cited that VanityFair.com article at the beginning of the show, because while that is their online presence, and that's not an article that was printed in their hard copy magazine, it indicates that we are moving this conversation slowly and gradually out into a public that maybe is now a little bit more capable of accepting this after all these years.
Yes, I hope so. I hope that that is the case.
I mean, you're
but
sort
I
of
can
a...
tell you, I received an email message tonight from a man who's challenging the Betty and Barney Hill story that has more evidence than any other case in the history of abductions. So, I mean, you still have some nasty people out there who are going to say, no, this didn't happen. These people are mentally ill, or these people have personality disorders. And there is a noisy group of negativists who will continue to say that sort of thing.
So, Denise, in your life right now, as a disclosed experiencer who now has published these experiences in a book, and obviously the book's just starting to hit, what do you foresee as the fallout potentially in your life? Do you believe that you maybe have accepting people around you, or that you maybe just enjoy a certain level of protection from the type of scorn that's usually heaped upon people who disclose?
Oh, boy. Well, when I decided to disclose, it was because I retired and because I have an awful lot of people around me that are very supportive of what I do and what I chose to do. Whether they believe in this or not, wherever their coping mechanism is and what they choose or decide they believe in, they still support what I'm doing. Whether they're a part of what I'm doing or not, it just didn't matter to them. It's very difficult for me to put all this into words. Almost every single one of my friends have purchased the book. Whether they believed or not, they want to read what I have written. They want to be more supportive because they have never found that I have told a lie to them in my lifetime. Co-workers that have now purchased the book and are going to read it and tell me what they think and what they feel, and some of them who I never mentioned this to before, I've had to warn them, look out, there's a book coming out. And some of them that have already read it and said, do you mean to tell me you lived with this? And never mentioned a word to me. And I said, that's exactly right. So you're going to have to decide what you think. I'm prepared for everything. But so far, none of them have thrown me under the bus.
Well, that in itself is actually kind of encouraging, because I have a lot of people in the background that I talk to and people that correspond with me who will not disclose publicly at this time because of pressures in their lives, and I understand that. But, you know, we've got to get to the point. Do either one of you have the sense, and I'll direct this to you, Denise, because you are an experiencer. Do you have the sense that the entities, the beings themselves, desire this disclosure? I mean, do you have any sense of that at all?
I would have to say that I do not. I almost have to say that they're letting us muddle through this on our own. We're going to have to make a decision. And yet at the same time, I have a funny feeling there's some government involvement, perhaps with these ETs, holding some of it back.
Do you know anything, have either of you researched or understood anything about a so-called treaty that was made back in the 1950s as a result, I think it was during Eisenhower administration, as a result of a meeting with ETs out at Edwards Air Force Base? Are you, either one of you, aware of agreements that potentially were made between what I will call the black ops side of our government and so-called malevolent ETs?
Both of them.
I have read, and Laura Eisenhower has made that statement that her grandfather was involved in this. But, boy, I mean, what can I say?
I don't know anything more except for what has been stated by Laura Eisenhower and what I have read.
And then also, Kathleen, you and I listened to Paul Hellyer regarding that matter this couple weekends ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was very fascinating.
Yeah, Paul Hellyer may be the missing link in all of this because he had background discussions as in his various seats in the Canadian government with sitting secretaries of defense and secretaries of state. And so, you know, slowly this has leaked out. I mean, I've interviewed people like Bob Dean, who has told me flat out, you know, we knew about this in 1962, that there were reports that were circulated then about alien presence. I mean, Bob Dean told me flat out that there are ETs walking the hallways of the Pentagon. I mean, that's a pretty brazen statement, but he's stuck to that statement consistently over the years.
Yes, and we had a member of our family who used to disappear on a regular basis and found out years later. He actually wrote a report for me for high school that had to do with aerospace, and the teachers wanted to know where I got the photographs that I had, and I couldn't give that information out. And this individual also worked for Area 51. He's passed away now, and he told me many times and told my husband, this exists. I've met an ET, and it just happens. I've been in a craft. He told me how ill he got. He told me what happened, and you could spend 5 minutes at a time in there. You had to come out, and they were trying to figure out how they could spend longer and longer periods of time in the craft, and I flat believed him. I knew the man enough years to know he was telling me the truth.
And also, a military man who's retired, but I cannot reveal his identity, and he refused to even make a deathbed statement in writing, told me that the military knows far more about this than we are aware of, and there is involvement between the military and the ETs, and that's about all he told me.
What is your opinion of this recent citizens' disclosure hearings that were held? Did you see any of the proceedings from that? Do you have any thoughts about what came out of that?
I purchased a live streaming video and watched as much of it as I possibly could. And I was most impressed by all of the pilots who and the men who work at the nuclear facilities who were there testifying, and particularly people, Colonel Halt and the people who were involved in the Rendlesham Forest case, who became ill after being near that craft, and whose medical records are classified, and they can't even acquire their medical records. I think that the former congresspeople who were present were impressed by that kind of testimony, and I think that, you know, eventually they began to take it very, very seriously and said that they would like to see testimony before the United Nations, a conference before the United Nations. So I'm very hopeful that that will occur.
I have a question that came up in our chat room, and I think this is directed to Denise. The question is, what beings are you in contact with? Are they always the same ones, and are you having a full awake contact?
Oh, yes, I have had several full awake contacts, and one main one that's been with me all my life, it's the same one, and he's a tall gray. He's got some of the features that Kathleen and I just changed to suit what I know exactly he looks like. And he looks like a gray, but he's got a little slight difference in the features. They're a little bit fuller than what some people draw, the little pointy chin. And, you know, this one has rounder features, but he is a gray. And he's a little taller. He's not 3 foot. He's more like 5 foot, a little over 5 foot tall, and he's always been there. I would call him my guide, my escort. And the other one is definitely insectoid. I call him the doctor, and he's done the majority of the medical procedures that have been done on me on the craft. He has always been there. Over and over again, the others I just call the soldiers. They're the smaller grays, and they seem to line the hallways as far as how I see them. I saw one other, and others have seen this one, and he's got a strange shape or form to his legs. And is this an insectoid? I'm not sure. Kathleen has had him drawn where he stands. It's a funny stance, and his legs are shaped like the letter M.
And he almost kind of like bow-legged, if I remember the graphic.
Kind of.
Yeah.
But he has an odd gait, and I think I've seen that one, and he actually cannot go through the wall but through glass, and kind of, it's almost a hop, and walks almost sideways, doesn't stand up straight. And Kathleen, what do you know about that one? That's what I've seen, and only once or twice.
Yes, and that's the one that most people will describe as either being insectoid or a praying mantis type of being. And something that really impressed me about the way that Denise described him under hypnosis is that he had extremely thin arms and legs, but arthritic-looking joints. They were very, very large joints. And that its head turned in a very unusual fashion, not like a human head. And as she described it, she would hold her chin and try to make her head move in that fashion, and just simply couldn't do it. Do you remember that, Denise? Can you describe that?
Yeah, the head, the neck was very thin, and it was almost like a hip joint, if you want to think of it that way, that the head should be able to swivel more on that joint than I could do with my own. And it's not like an owl either. It's very difficult to describe. And the eyes are strange. They're extremely different. They blink, but it's not eyelids.
Do they have round eyes, or are they...
No.
They're elliptical?
No. They're pointy at each end, up and down. Not horizontal, but up and down, and very narrow.
Okay.
And they come very close to you. So I had a flashback while I was in an MRI machine where the techs were staring in at me and became those creatures. Because the sound, the whole atmosphere of this MRI thing was just like the sound in a craft. And the people standing outside it flashed back to those entities and reached inside the machine, and it just became the craft for me, and I couldn't tell them. It was very frightening.
You're saying that the inside of an MRI is very similar to what you're experiencing inside of a UFO?
Yes, the sound inside an MRI machine is about as close as you can get to one of the sounds inside a craft. Yes.
That actually makes a fair amount of sense, given that we're talking about, probably in both cases, some form of electromagnetic power. And that's one of the aspects to your book you talk about a little bit. You want to talk a little bit about what you believe is behind the alien technology?
Well, there are actually a couple of different kinds. The larger craft that I was taking in is not run by that method at all. There may be magnetics involved, but the center core affected me so horrifically that my muscles and my nerves were involved, and it was very painful. And as I approached the doorway, I started to react, and I was under hypnosis as I was shown this. And Kathleen recognized that I was in pain and that I was having some sort of body movement that didn't look normal at all. And I was in some discomfort, and she stopped that by suggesting that I calm down and just observe the situation and to be able to tell her what I was seeing. And then when she brought me out of hypnosis, I decided after a period of time that I wanted to do this again. I wanted to feel the whole thing, and I wanted it videotaped. I wanted to see for myself what it looked like, because I had brought back some of that in real life, and they can't diagnose it. They don't know, the doctors, what it is, and they haven't been able to see it. And I wanted to see if it looked under hypnosis, so she videotaped it, took back.
I have a question. Yeah, go ahead.
I was saying, just to add that Denise gave me permission to play that video. I lecture in Roswell over the July 4th, and also at the Answers Speak Conference in Portland, Maine in September. They're both listed on my website.
Yeah, we're experiencing massive phone line problems right now, so I may have to, sometimes ask you or re-ask you a question. I don't know what's going on with our phone lines, but they're degrading. I have a follow-up question in the chat room. When you are in telepathic communication, assuming that you are, do they or are they this question's phrased kind of awkwardly. Is there a back and forth between you and them in terms of impressions that you received, Denise?
Some of the time, I don't usually think or feel like I can ask a lot of questions. I certainly can let them know that I'm afraid, or let them know, get the point across, why am I here, when am I going home, that type of thing. I'm going to try and change that if I'm taken again. I'm more curious as to what's going on. Also, what am I going to be shown next? What is this all about? Definitely that happens. Their information to me, it can be a rapid download. There's so much pumped into my brain that I can't get out. Something stops it, or they need to tell me that they're going to be doing a procedure, and it gets across really quickly, and I know what it is, I know what's going to happen, and that's the end of it.
Okay, I hope that...
They're not conversationalists at all.
Okay, so there's not a lot of back and forth in terms of them explaining things to you, but do they sense that you're curious about things? Do they address that in any way?
I'm sure by a questioning look on a face that I have seen a couple of times, a look like, what is this being or human feeling? What is this person sensing? It was almost like they were studying me. But it wasn't addressed, not in any shape or form. And I am sure that they knew I had questions. I had feelings of, why is this happening to me? Here we go again, that type of thing. But it was never mentioned.
There was an area that I wanted to go into a little bit, and in your book, and I may be wrong, because I know that both of you as researchers, while you are very thorough and I would say very receptive of people's experiences, you both have what I consider to be a healthy skeptical edge, and that's not an insult. I believe skepticism is a healthy thing. I think what you get in terms of scoffers out there are cynics who are basically COINTELPRO people who are hitmen against experiencers. But one of the things that I didn't see addressed in the book was, have you explored at all the potential links between experiencers and the military? And the reason I ask this is because it's a pattern that I've noted. Denise, you said your father worked in the aerospace industry. You also worked in the defense industry as well, didn't you?
Yes, I did. I don't go a lot into that because we've had some recent possible interference.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we decided not to discuss that at length for a while to see if it stops.
Got it. Got it. You answered my question. Thank you. That was a perfect answer. It was done well. It is one of those areas that I research because it's something that I've noted for a long time. We're coming up on about the last few minutes of the show tonight, and maybe both of you could just give me a summary of both what you have gained out of doing this book together and what you expect in any future projects you have planned, either individually or together.
Well,
go ahead, Kathleen.
Okay. I have to say that Denise simply had a wealth of knowledge. As having been a UFO and abduction investigator for 21 years, and also having been an experiencer herself, gave her special insight that most people simply don't have. And the fact that she recalls so much of this in such detail is really very, very remarkable, and she's an excellent hypnotic subject at the same time. I'm fortunate enough to live near her so that we can continue to investigate her experiences as they occur. And I just have to say that I continue to move on. I don't have a lot of long-term plans. I take things as they come, and I move in whatever direction it is that I need to go in at that particular time. Mm. But Denise and I are going to be working on another commonality study to ask some questions that we didn't ask on the first study that we did. And
we didn't talk about your study a whole lot. Maybe just briefly touch upon that. I didn't bring that up. What you call them, the Morton Stoner survey that's part of this book?
Yes, Denise and I had developed a survey. It had 45 questions, and we advertised widely for participants. We had to have 50 in my mind, with my background in sociology, in order to make this a valid study. It took us a year to accomplish. We had self-identified experiences who took part in this, as well as some people who whose events are widely known and believed to have actually occurred, who participated as well. And we also had a 25-person control group, so to speak, of individuals who stated that they had not had a UFO abduction experience. And in the end, we found 23 commonalities among experiencers, which is very compelling. We've talked about that in the book quite extensively. Denise has all 23 of those commonalities, and Jenny, the second person we wrote about, has all 23 as well.
That's a fascinating survey or questionnaire or study, and I have felt compelled, the word I used the other night with Kathleen, to move forward on another questionnaire, and Kathleen doesn't know it, but I've now got 30 more questions with questions built in for her to look at for the next study to send to her.
That's great. After we did the survey, people came up to us and said, well, why didn't you ask this, or why didn't you ask that? So we started writing down the questions that they would like to know the answers to so that they will be included on this next survey as we go along.
Well, it sounds like you've developed a methodology in bringing out more details, looking at the questions that are in the survey and reading the statistics. Do you have a statistical abstract for a database that you're keeping with subject responses on these Q&As?
Well, I can tell you that it's more than an abstract. I do have all of the results in my computer, and I did the statistical analysis. But anyone can go to my website and read the report, which is posted there at kathleen-marden.com.
Excellent. Denise, what's in your future? Do you plan to continue doing more work on your own past and investigations within or without MUFON?
Well, I have been working independently all along, and I'm also working with a group out of Pennsylvania that I have gone ahead and helped them to grow and extend.
Oh,
by
really? I'm in Pennsylvania.
I know. Well, it's Butch Witkowski.
Okay, I know who that is, yes.
Okay, he has now got at least two full vans fully equipped with equipment like you wouldn't believe, and he can pull those vans up, get in them, and travel to any point that he needs to go to for research.
I need to talk to him. Yeah, he's...
Yes.
He's doing some interesting stuff. We were in contact a while back, but, you know, things drop in and out. That sounds very interesting.
Yes, you need to take a look at that site, and he's going to be coming down and speaking to my group in the next couple of months. He's going to bring down a van so that we can all take a look. He's got equipment that's just absolutely unbelievable, and some things he's doing will be important. And then I'm going to be holding a meeting this summer at some point for abductees, and then I want to get this next study out. I feel like it's going to be really, really important. I want to go a little more in depth with Kathleen's okay, because I want it to be something that both of us do. Since we put out the first one together, I'd like the second one to be something we do together also.
Well, it sounds like you have a good working relationship together. The only other thing I was going to ask you is, statistically, I know the statistical field on abductees is strongly slanted towards females. Is anyone doing work extensively with male contactees and the details behind that?
Well, I think
I can tell you that many men have contacted me recently, and I believe that it's more men than women who have.
Really? Now that's surprising.
Yes, yes. But on our survey, there were about twice as many women as men who participated, and we found that in the control group, there were more men than women who participated, so it wasn't a matter of women being more likely to fill out a questionnaire. But yes, more recently, many, many men have been in touch with me.
Yeah, that's an area I would like to see.
Too.
Go ahead, Denise. I'm sorry, Denise.
Oh, I would have to say that also, that men, they're a little bit more sneaky, because they'll come in the back door and catch you unawares.
Mm-hmm.
Say, I really need to talk about this, and can I keep your confidence? And, you know, they're a little bit more careful because of their jobs and their families and their situation. And women are tending to come out more now than men, but I find it about equal from my experience. Everybody's a little different.
Well, that may be one data point tonight that I walk away with, because my own background and experiences that so far I've seen predominantly women abductees. Obviously, the males are out there, but my suspicion is that they're just the guys haven't come forward yet. So it's good to hear that. As we're wrapping up here, one more time, to let people know where they can find you, where they can find the book.
Okay. My website is Kathleen-Marden.com, and you can purchase the alien abduction files there if you'd like an autographed copy. Also, my lectures this year, and I will be actually in Pittsburgh in November as well.
Excellent. That's Pennsylvania, Western Pennsylvania, Eastern. Yeah, Western Pennsylvania MUFON meeting, right.
Yeah, that's correct.
Good, excellent. I want to thank you both for coming on tonight and for taking time and for being patient with us through the tech glitches and for answering so many questions with so much depth. This was a very, very interesting show for me tonight, and I think the listeners, the folks in the chat room, were pretty engaged by it as well. So my thanks again to you, Kathleen Marden and Denise Stoner, for coming on Off Planet Radio tonight. Hope to talk to you both very soon.
Thank you. Us too. Thanks for having us on.
And that's going to close it out for tonight. We'll be back next week with Chris Holly will be with me as my co-host, and our guest will be ufologist and radio talk show host Kate Valentine. That's next week on Off Planet Radio. I'm Randy Moggins. The truth is out there. It's inside you. And give a look for it.